You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
Everybody, welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. We are back. This is this is episode, I'm gonna say 660, as we're recording them out of sync here a little bit, but it should be 660, I believe. So Will chose a doozy for 660, or what we hoped was a doozy. I don't know. How do you say this? You roll the dice all the time.
Roll the dice, man. You don't think twice.
Yes, indeed. This week we're going to be talking about The Prey of the Jaguar, 1996.
A glorious year for some.
Yeah.
Not all.
And that's directed by David Decatou. Who's directed about 200 films. But I don't know.
In this genre.
Yeah. But I don't know that he's ever been on the show. I feel like he has.
I feel like he has as well, but.
I'm not sure that he has, to be honest with you. That's a weird one to go that long and not have another Dave Decatou. Sorry. I just wanted to see if there was other Dave films on the thing. So Will chose this one. And we'll see what we get. We'll see what we get out of it. It's almost like I'm blaming. Hey, it's almost like I'm blaming you. I keep saying, okay. Will chose this one.
I've got Jaguar thick skin, baby.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the only Decatou film. The film we've done. We've probably talked about him quite a bit because of the. This, you know, the amount of films he's done. So we'll talk about him a little bit more here as we go along. So that's what we're doing. How you been, Will? Doing all right?
I've been good.
Good.
I've been good. Getting into Christmas mode. Hope everyone south of us in the United States, including you, my friend, had a good Thanksgiving.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, wasn't bad.
Did you wear stretchy pants?
Did not.
Rookie move, my friend.
Typically, I don't eat that much at Thanksgiving, to be honest with you. That's one of the few holidays I don't really eat that much. It's a strange one, but I really don't. I don't really overdo it on that day for whatever reason. I'm more of an overdo it randomly kind of person than a overdo it on the holidays type person. I'd say the one thing that I can run into around the holidays is I can eat more than I normally do of, you know, baked goods, things like that. Not that I don't eat a lot of those anyway, but I'd probably around the end of the year eat way too much of those because a lot of those are just floating around, cookies and cakes and cupcakes and pies and all kinds of stuff. You know, so it's kind of hard to avoid it, but, you know, I just, you know, I don't eat that much of that stuff, to be honest with you. I've always been a weird Thanksgiving person because I'm not a turkey guy, really. I'm like a turkey sandwich kind of guy, so I'm good with the turkey the next day. And I'm a dark meat kind of guy anyway. I don't eat white meat, really, or, you know, like dry meat. I don't eat that white stuff. I don't eat that hunky shit. And so, you know, a lot of times whenever I ate Thanksgiving dinner, I always have plenty to choose from because a lot of people wouldn't eat the dark meat. And I've always found that kind of amazing because turkey dark meat is pretty solid, got to say.
Pretty it is. Solid. It's underrated, I think. It's I like both, but I like definitely to have the dark meat in the mix because it just has more flavor and it's juicier.
Yeah, it's got the juice. It's got the juice. I like it. But yeah, junk food is the bigger problem around those holidays for me than anything.
Oh, yeah.
That and probably deviled eggs. I'm a big deviled egg guy. I'll throw down some deviled eggs.
I also adore and can crush a tray of deviled eggs.
Yeah, I know.
Without mercy.
Without mercy. Yeah, you'll say, well, here, have a deviled egg. And I'm like, one? Come on. Now that is a rookie move. There's no one deviled egg. Come on. Give me the whole tray. I'll just slide them right down my gullet.
If you think one tray of deviled eggs is enough, double it.
Yeah, double it. Yep. Double your devil. Just double the devil. Yep. The devil's double. Double the devil.
It's better than a daily double, man.
Yeah. Pretty good. But yeah, no, otherwise it was good. I think we went to the movies that night, me and the kids, see something my daughter wanted to see. So it was a good night. It was a nice day. It's just so weird now, you know. I mean, when I was a kid, and you know, maybe I'm just remembering it differently and everything, but Thanksgiving, you already had, you know, winter jackets out and things like that. I mean, I got to be honest with you, here in where I live, I haven't worn, it's very weird. I haven't worn a winter jacket, a full on winter jacket now for, I'm going to say 5 years in the winter. So,
wow.
Don't know what that says about the state of the world. I think I got a hunch. But yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
When I was growing up, by the time October hit, it wasn't uncommon to wear a winter jacket when you were trick-or-treating. So times have definitely changed. Things have definitely changed. Now it doesn't get cold here until about, I don't know, mid-January, February. It was 58 yesterday. So.
Yeah, it was about 41 here, but yeah. That's good for December 1st in our neck of the woods.
Yeah. Listen to how exciting this podcast is. We're talking about Thanksgiving. We're talking about...
Jesus, old as shit. Let's get into some stuff, man.
So my knee's been bothering me, and I don't know...
I got some ringing in my ear.
When I woke up this morning, I creaked and cracked. Oh. Anyway. Sorry, guys. Sorry. Yeah, let's get into some stuff. Let's see what we got. I think I might have a piece of feedback from our lovely listener, Mr. Walt. And I got to get over here and check. And I'm pretty sure I didn't. I think he puts the date on there. Thank you, Walt. Appreciate that. So I can remember if I played it or not, I think. Or maybe if he can remember if he sent it or not. Either way, thanks, Walt. But I'm going to try to play it here. Here we go.
Gentlemen, it's Walt. So nice to be talking to you again. Just like to start by saying that I appreciate so much what you guys do. Last week's review of Barbarella. Very interesting. That's an interesting movie. Your obituary this week. Joss Ackland.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you guys will, of course, know him from Lethal Weapon 2. Right up the alley of the gentleman. I also know him from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. And by coincidence, about a week ago, I happened to watch the movie The Apple.
There we go.
But Lethal Weapon 2. Let's just stick to that, okay? Your This or That this week. Better writer directorial vanity project. Tough Guys Don't Dance or Maximum Overdrive. Thanks, guys.
Yeesh.
Oh, wow.
Yeesh. Well, thanks, Walt, first of all, as always. And, yeah, Joss Ackland. He lived a long time. I remember Lethal Weapon 2, obviously, but he kind of became kind of synonymous with the, kind of the foreign white bad guy for a little while. Because he had a great, he had a great face for that kind of stuff.
He had a great look. He looked like a heavy, right?
Yeah, he did. But I'm sure there's lots of Joss Ackland that we've seen and haven't seen that we don't remember. That I didn't do any research for that voicemail. So either way, nice long life. And yeah, rest in peace to Joss.
The eyes.
Yeah, the eyes.
His eyes, right? He was good with his eyes. They had sort of a knowing menace behind them. You could turn it on.
Yeah, you could. All right. Tough Guys Don't Dance. That would be Norman Mailer, right? Is that who it is?
That is Mailer, yep.
Or Maximum Overdrive, which is Stephen King. Now, first of all, we should address the fact that those are two totally different type of authors. But these are...
Both great American authors in their own right, though.
Yeah. But these are interesting takes on the Vanity Project, yes. I guess you could say they are vanity projects. Although, knowing a lot about Maximum Overdrive, I got to say, I think Stephen King, I think it was more of a lark, more of a, can I do this? Mm-hmm. And I think knowing,
more of a cokey confidence, I am going to do this.
Yeah. And then knowing Norman Mailer, it was more like, well, Jesus, anybody can do it. Anybody can make a movie. And the products kind of speak for themselves. So what do you think? Which one would you choose here?
I think this is a very classic apples and oranges. But in the interest of This or That, in the interest of our good friend Walt's question, I quite like Tough Guys Don't Dance. I love the book, should be said. Huh. Love the book. I don't think, obviously, the film probably came out the way Mailer would have liked. Yeah. Poor Ryan O'Neill with his, oh God, oh man. sequence. But I prefer Tough Guys Don't Dance. I like the film. I think that moment he's kind of hung out to dry, but I love the film. I've wanted to cover it on the show forever. Mm-hmm. And I love the book. I love Maximum Overdrive. We've covered it on the show. I think if it was a This or That with the soundtracks or scores for the film, Overdrive's taken it. And I love Overdrive, but I got to go Tough Guys with this one.
Nice. Interesting. Yeah, you know, Tough Guys, there's a lot to talk about there because, you know, it's got an interesting history, an interesting cast. I think Mailer and Robert Towne
are
the writers on it. And Robert Towne's a very renowned, don't get to use that word a lot, screenwriter.
Not in our circles, baby.
And, you know, David DiCatu. Ryan O'Neill, an actor that, if there's an actor for me, and I do not mean this in a mean way. I really do not. Because I do like some of his films. I like him in Paper Moon a lot. I like him in Barry Lyndon a lot. But if there's an actor to me that is the epitome of the vanilla wafer, it is Ryan O'Neill.
I thought you were going to say Maxwell Caulfield.
It's not far removed. But I will say that Ryan O'Neill is better than Maxwell Caulfield.
I like Ryan O'Neill. It's weird. I don't know that there's ever been an actor that whose life depended so much on the director that was directing him.
It really is the case, yes.
Walter Hill makes him Steve McQueen.
Yeah. No, he's I like him in that film as well. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's got films I like. He really does.
I think...
But yeah, I just don't, I mean, for whatever reason. For whatever reason, he's never really done anything for me. And I don't know what that is.
Either. It's weird. He was like you said, Paper Moon. He gets a chance to show some charm, but it's interesting. Yeah, a lot of it is, and I mean, this is sort of an obvious statement, but a lot of it's dependent on the director, right? But for him, he really lived and died with the director that was sort of shepherding him through the performance.
Yeah,
I guess you could say about everyone, but it just feels very evident with him, like sore thumb.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's interesting his filmography and career. I mean, there's really just a steep hill he almost falls off of, and
cliff.
I don't know what happened. He's definitely a product of the 70s. You can definitely say that, and arguably, you know, became a box office hit, and you know, worked with you know Bogdanovich and people like that, and that helped him quite a bit. So he's kind of synonymous with that. And of course, I do like The Driver a lot, but I don't know, whatever it is, he just never has really done anything for me. I don't know why. And again, like I said, I don't mean it in an insulting way. Just he's not the first actor I think, hey, I want to watch a Ryan O'Neill film. I think that it's more like I want to watch a Walter Hill film, and it just so happens to have Ryan O'Neill in it. Or I want to watch a Stanley Kubrick film, and it happens to have Ryan O'Neill in it. You know what I mean? It's more like that kind of.
No, I get you. I don't see people like Jack Nicholson or De Niro and so forth. Yeah, you want to seek them out sometimes for their performance, but I don't know how many of his films I've sought because they were Ryan O'Neill vehicles versus the director that was using him. But I will defend him as someone who's put in some very good performances in the right hands.
He is. Yes. I have to agree with that
question. Then I guess are you Maximum Overdrive?
I'm going to say I am Maximum Overdrive. I do like Tough Guys Don't Dance. I don't know if I like it for the reasons that you should, but, I do like it a lot because it has, well, Wings Hauser's in there and,
fuck yeah,
it's got, him and it's got, I think Lawrence Tierney's in it, if I remember right.
I believe so.
Obviously,
the female lead is. It's not Jessica Lange. Who is it?
I can't remember if it's Isabella Rossellini or. I know she's in it, but I can't remember if she's the lead.
It is. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. Mm-hmm.
But there's another actress in there, but I can't remember her name off the top of my head. But they tried to give her a push in the 80s. But I remember Penn and Teller, I think, is in it. I think. I might be wrong, but I don't think it's the guy. I think what is Mission Impossible 3 guy? Or Mission Impossible guy? My bad. Clarence Williams. I think he's in it.
Oh, he of Tales from the Hood fame.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I remember most about Tough Guys Don't Dance is it was Cannon trying to kind of get into the critical acclaim world too.
Prestige. Yeah, they had their moment where they tried to pivot away from the Norris Bronson money,
which I think they received some nominations. Was it for Runaway Train maybe?
Yeah. They had a couple of films where they were starting to kind of shift gears. Yeah.
Yeah. So that might've been it. But anyway, I need to rewatch Tough Guys Don't Dance because it is something, but
I'd love to put it on the show, man. I love it.
Yeah. So I'm going
to
get
Walt.
Yeah. Thank you to Walt. I'm going to go Stephen King on that one. Yeah. But I didn't, you know, when we reviewed Maximum Overdrive, I remember liking Maximum Overdrive more before we reviewed it. When we reviewed it critically, it was quite the task.
There was a few moments that were not great. I mean, I still think of it fondly as we're talking about it now.
It still means something to me, but it, I wouldn't put it up there with great films, but you know, hey, he directed a film, and again, you know, it's easy for me to sit around here and talk about movies. I've never made a movie, so there you go. Okay, let's get into a little bit of what we've been watching. Thanks, Walt, as always. What do you got, man? You got anything?
I got a few. I got a dog who's pushing at me to pet and sort of rub and eat the crumbs off my toast plate, and but I also have some films I've watched.
Nice.
She makes like Maurizio Merli busting in the door, man. She's a pint-sized dynamo. I watched a few things, as a matter of fact, as we're known to do around these parts. Let me see where I left off here. I think I talked about, oh man, did I talk about Thanksgiving on the show?
Yeah, you did.
Okay. I don't think I talked about, well, I got some good stuff. Shit. So it was my birthday a couple weeks ago, and I always like to, my birthday pick is, in our house we have this democracy where we rotate our picks, and we sometimes there's high stakes trades of picks. Uh-huh. Birthdays, it's like the bonus pick. So this year I want, I always try to pick something really meaningful, something I've really wanted to watch, something that maybe, I think is going to be really be something exceptional. And this year I did just that. I picked Hirozaku Koreeda's Shoplifters.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'd meant to see from a few years ago. And I absolutely loved it. Have you had a chance to see this
yet?
No,
I have not. I know almost everybody I know that has seen it, loves it or likes it quite a bit.
Oh, man. It's so good. I find even as I'm a man in his mid-40s, his work just speaks to me even more now. I remember seeing his films in my late 20s and really loving them, and the humanity in them was evident and affecting to me even then, but now even more so. And it's like that thing we talk about with some filmmakers. I don't want to call him a one-trick pony, but like, the magic he's going to give you. Mm-hmm. You know it, but it somehow works every time. It's a beautiful film. Beautiful film. There's not too many people doing what he does better than him. So, great stuff. Next up was one. So our youngest, he's fascinated with space, and so we had seen Richard Linklater's 10 and a Half pop up on Netflix. It's been on there for a while, but I don't know. I don't use Netflix a lot.
Oh yeah, Apollo 10 and a Half. That's right. Yeah.
Apollo 10 and a Half. Yeah. And my wife, he and I sat down to watch this. And Linklater uses, just to be, if people don't know, employs sort of that rotoscope animation that he used on Scanner Darkly. We all really love this, man.
Yeah.
We really love this. It feels very much like an episode of The Wonder Years.
Nice.
Like the Houston edition. But it doesn't do anything different. It doesn't do anything new. It's kind of more sort of an observation of childhood. But there's something about it I really loved, man. And I think Linklater's another guy who, you kind of know what you're going to get with him. But this was a joy for all of us. All of us came away really enjoying it. So
that's good.
Yeah, we dug, man. It was good.
Yeah, I've been like so many things. There's a lot of stuff that I have, what's the word, added to my, queue.
Yep.
And just have never checked it out. You know what I mean?
No, buddy, that's how it goes. Right. But I'll say this, I would put this thing, if we were going to do a top 30 of the year, I would put this in, it would be in like the 21 to 30 range, but came away really enjoying it. Really enjoy it.
Nice. I need to check it out. I've been meaning to, but I just haven't had a chance. So much. Just the story of my life.
Story of my life. It's a way of life. Yeah. It's not just a costume.
That's right.
Last thing I'll talk about, it's a short, but I want to mention it. I think I talked about the Henry Sugar one last time. So the Roald Dahl adaptation that our guy Wes Anderson did, The Rat Catcher.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is a bit of a bizarre one, man. But Ralph Fiennes is really great. It's what can I say? It's great. It's so good that it's 17 minutes, because it would be so fatiguing at 90 or 100 minutes the way it's presented. But it works so well at that length. Uh-huh. One night we were pressed for time. By the time we all sat down, we had like 20 minutes. Threw it on and enjoyed it, man. It's just hand in glove. Anderson's work and his sort of sensibilities as a filmmaker with Dahl's work, which he clearly loves and has a deep affection for, right? So mm-hmm. Really enjoyed it, man.
Seems to be the thing that speaks to him the most. It's somehow those two things seem to collide well for whatever reason.
Yeah, they really do. right? So, and it's cool for me to see more so William. William really loves Anderson's aesthetic. He's really excited to watch Grand Budapest, which is now out digitally as well as physically. So nice. We missed it in theaters, man. We were kind of bummed. We wanted to see it in the theaters and didn't get a chance to.
You're talking about Asteroid City, right?
What did I say?
Grand Budapest.
Ooh, whoops. Ironically, my younger son did the same thing last night. He mistakenly said to all of us, because we were talking about whose pick it was for movie night, and he goes, William, he goes, you picked Grand Budapest, and we started and didn't finish it. That's not our fault. we were quick to correct him, but now the shoe is on the other foot, baby, I'm getting corrected.
That's right.
Oh, good Lord. Asteroid City, man.
Yeah, Asteroid City. Yeah, it's out there. I don't know. I haven't watched a Wes Anderson film since, either Mr. Fox or Moonrise Kingdom. And honestly, he doesn't attract me much anymore.
Nope, that's fair.
Yeah, just for whatever his aesthetic, I've grown weary of it, I guess. I don't know what it is.
He's fatiguing to some, and I get that.
Yeah.
I totally get that.
But it's weird, though, because some of his aesthetic is tied to one of my favorite filmmakers, Stanley Kubrick. But for whatever reason, it's his sense of humor that I don't find his movies funny. I find them quite droll, but I think that might be the point.
Well, I think he might be a bit too twee for you.
Maybe. There's just something off about the sense of humor to me. Like the characters are never quite as funny as I want them to be.
Yeah, maybe the stakes aren't really. There's no real stakes, I guess, in his films.
Well, I'll give him credit for this though. His sense of humor has maintained from Bottle Rocket all the way on.
Way through, yeah.
All the way through, because if you go back and look at Bottle Rocket, the sense of humor's there. And even then, I thought it was a bit odd, but I did like it quite a bit, even though I thought, my recollection of Bottle Rocket was it was too long, but I did enjoy the film. But most of his films feel that way for me. They just feel, I don't know, there's maybe droll's a bad word, but it just, that's the way they feel. They feel like homework more than they feel like entertainment, if that makes sense.
It does, and it's funny to me. I have the exact opposite feeling. I get so much joy. I just find myself perpetually charmed and smiling watching his work. But isn't that funny? Like you and I tend to be on the same page with most things cinematically, or at least in the same realm. But that's clearly one guy that.
Like I said, don't dislike him. I just don't pursue him.
Yeah.
Maybe one of these days I'll sit down and say I'm going to watch Wes Anderson films. But I don't know that it would be healthy to watch all of his films back to back to back, because that's the other sensation. Is the other sensation I usually get is they don't feel. I don't know, man. I just think he's one of those filmmakers who probably just doesn't speak to me as much as I would like, right? So,
hey, that's how it goes, man.
But I did, I do like some of his films quite a bit. I don't think I've ever liked anything as much as I like Bottle Rocket. I still think I like Bottle Rocket the most. And
first was tight.
Yeah, maybe followed by Rushmore. But after that, it's kind of a push and pull. I did like Fantastic Mr. Fox a lot, though.
Fox is incredible. But he gets very Wes Anderson the further along he goes, right?
Yes, he does.
The thing, it's no different than even like Kubrick, speaking of influences for him, like we'd mentioned earlier, the more Kubrick worked, the more his, he Kubrickian. Yep. Whereas his early stuff, the studio stuff, there's flourishes in there, but it's not as, you could watch 30 seconds of a Kubrick film you didn't know late in his career and you'd know it's Kubrick, whereas his early stuff is very good. It's just, when I say anonymous, I don't mean that in a bad way. Just
right.
He's making a studio film.
Right.
Same with the old Wessie boy.
Yeah. Okay. I watched a few things. I checked out a film on the Negro Leagues called The League. I'd been tracking this one for a while.
I want to see this.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It was on Hulu down here. It kind of came across. I've been watching on iTunes because the price had been dropping on it, and I was just going to buy it because I am a bit of a Negro League aficionado. But I checked it out. It's pretty good. It's not going to teach you anything you probably don't know if you know a lot about the Negro Leagues. But if you don't, then I would check it out. I mean, if you're not very aware of hardly any of the stuff that happened during that era, it's definitely worth a watch. If you're already a bit of a scholar, it's a bit of a greatest hits package, but I still enjoyed the film quite a bit, so I would recommend people check it out. Watched Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving 3 for the Not a Bomb Breaking Brad experiment. So if you want to hear more about that, you can check those episodes out, but that was interesting. November night, my daughter wanted to see Trolls Band Together, which is the third of the Trolls films. And so me and my son and her, we went to the movies and checked that out. And it's pretty much what you expect from these films. Very much, pop art, pop music type thing. This one takes the Justin Timberlake angle quite a bit. He voices one of the characters in this series, and it takes that angle quite a bit with a bunch of boy band stuff and things like that. And so it's kind of funny. There's a lot of boy band inside jokes there and stuff, and some of that stuff that I obviously Timberlake's kind of making fun of himself a bit too. So that's kind of good. But the film overall, it's not great. Although I will say this, man, and I say this all the time. It's funny. I'll go see these animated films with my daughter, who's still really into the animation, doesn't really care much for the live action stuff. And I'll go in there and it'll be some, obviously I think the Trolls, they probably wanted to make good money, but I go in there thinking, well, this ain't going to be much. It's just going to be a standard animation film. And then I see the animation and I'm like, good Lord. I mean, how much, I say this all the time on the show, how much further along is this animation technology going to get? Because these films, they look unreal sometimes now. They just look insane. And like to the point to where the animation looks so good that a lot of companies are trying to do other things to get back to looking like animation.
I know. It has this plasticky sheen and it's...
Yeah. Yeah. It looks so real. I mean, there were some moments in Trolls 3 where I was like, wow, look at that. That looks insane.
Yeah.
Just like the textures and things just looked insane. So that kind of caught me off guard for a minute. So, but we had a good time.
So you enjoyed it well enough for what it was, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. The Trolls films are, I probably like the first one of the three the most. But I enjoy them for what they are, which is basically a piece of bubble gum. Would I ever watch them again? Not myself. No, but with my daughter around, probably yes.
Okay, there you go.
Then I switched gears. My daughter wanted to watch Coffin Joe, The Strange World of Jose Mojica Marines. No, she did not. She wanted to switch gears completely, go to a different type of troll. This is I believe this documentary is on the Arrow box set. It's just an hour long, a little bit over an hour long. It's on the Arrow channel right now. So I checked it out. I'd seen another Coffin Joe documentary before. I think this is a different one. This one has a lot more Coffin Joe in there. And it's interesting. It's interesting. I'll tell you this, though, because a lot of people, documentaries don't really have spoilers. But if you don't want to hear this, then maybe fast forward an hour, or not an hour. Jesus, not that long of a conversation. But maybe fast forward 10 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever. But there's this, so Coffin Joe's making movies in Brazil. He's not making a lot of money. But he's not giving up. He's got the artistic flair. He's going to go for it. He's not cutting those fingernails. He's going the whole way, and he's going to stick to his guns. Admire that. I truly do. But I tell you what, coming out of this, there was some weirdness that came out of it that I didn't know about. So I didn't know. I knew he had made some porn films because, like he said, he had to eat. But I didn't know he made bestiality films. And that's rough enough to discover. Not that, it's not like he's a hero of mine. I got a velvet painting of him on a wall or something like that. But, the weird part is one of the producers and his friends goes into this bit about how he really liked the dog and how the dog was a really good actor.
And, come on.
And... It's a weird moment, dude. It's a weird moment. You got to see it to believe it. It's a weird moment.
Jeez.
And he's talking about how good the actor did, he's talking about how good the actor did. It's the dog. And he said he admired the dog and everything else. And I'm sitting there kind of with my mouth open, kind of like, I can't believe I'm watching this right now, you know? And then I'm sitting there thinking, is this a cultural thing? Is this, you know,
no.
Is in Brazilian culture, is it, you know, cooler to have a German Shepherd that likes to party?
Yeah, or, no kidding, man. Like Spuds McKenzie.
Yeah. Is it like you're something you're proud of your dog for, you know, or something? I don't know.
Definitely not.
It was just really, it was really awkward. And I'm watching it by myself and it's still awkward.
It's still awkward. Absolutely.
And that was the concern. So yeah, if you want to see something odd, watch that documentary and you'll run across that. And of course, if you don't know anything about Coffin Joe, it's worth a watch, but if you bought that box set, you'll get it anyway. So, and then, check that out if you want to see a really weird story of, you know, a guy admiring a dog for what he did to a female in a movie that Coffin Joe directed.
They don't talk to the woman,
no, but the Brazilian papers are so weird. They got a picture of the dog. They got a picture of the girl. I think she's mostly naked. And, you know, they're just kind of talking about it. And I'm sitting there thinking, Jesus, that picture would be illegal in the States. it's very weird. Yeah, whatever. Just a weird kind of midnight cinema tangent there that, you know, there's a certain things that, you know, you run across in this world of looking at exploitation films and you're just like, wow, no, thank you.
Yeah.
So, and for the record, you know, some of that stuff was going on in the late 60s and 70s, you know, that there's been the story of the, what's her name? The deep throat lady, Linda Lovelace. I think she did one of those or supposedly did one of those. I don't know. I never pursued it, but, there was some of that bestiality crap going around, back in the day. So the cross species porn, well, bro.
Listen, I'll say one thing about that. You're right. And it's interesting, kind of a sidebar to what you're saying, but also related to what you're saying. I feel like as we get older, you look at some of the exploitation films. Like I was explaining to a buddy of mine who watched a lot of horror and genre stuff, but wasn't really aware that Nazi exploitation was a thing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, had no idea. Just some of the stuff, some of the muck and the sleaze, like you said, like this Coffin Joe stuff or stuff like that, or a lot of the stuff that in our early years we would have talked about. Or at least would have been kind of in the circles of, you know, everyone would have seen it, watched it. Very different times. But to your point about the bestiality thing, I remember working at Wendy's when I was a teenager. And I had this Polish girl I was friends with. And she had a dupe, like a VHS tape. It was bestiality tape. So I said, let me borrow it. I'm going to a party on Friday. I want to pop it in the VCR right in the living room of while the party's going on.
Yikes.
So I did. And I thought it was hilarious. At the time, I was about, you know, 16. But yeah, not, maybe not my finest hour, but
oh, well,
I guess I'll chalk it up to
youth.
Things were very different at the time. I thought it was hilarious. Yeah. I thought it was hilarious, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the innocence of youth is, I mean, you know, it is what it is, right? I mean, you're trying to do a tasteless, funny joke, something harmless, in your opinion.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
But also offend people at the same time. So yeah, it's
shock them.
But, yeah, yeah.
And it's like that thing now. I bet you nowadays, if someone did that, I mean, they'd be a social pariah.
They would be, yeah, if it got out, they would be. But I guarantee you that stuff still happens. I guarantee you it still does, because kids will always be kids. They will always try to shock each other.
Yeah.
They will always try to one-up each other. That's what kids do. So it has nothing to do with the way they're raised or anything like that. You know, it just has to do with, dude, you think you've seen something. Check this out, you know. So
yeah, of course, man.
As a matter of fact, I don't even want to know what kids are looking at nowadays with YouTube and everything else. There's no telling. So many things have video archives and everything now. Oof, I don't even know how you monitor this stuff. Yeah,
comparison.
Probably. Coffin Joe would say so. The only other thing I watched is I finally sat down and watched The Card Counter. And I was going to watch, I watched this because I wanted to watch the Joel Edgerton film that Schrader did. the was it the Gardner film, Master Gardener or something like that. I wanted to watch that, and in order to watch that, I felt like, because he kind of made these three films kind of back to back to back, to do that, I wanted to watch The Card Counter first. And I remember some of the complaints about The Card Counter and stuff, but I got to say, I really like The Card Counter quite a bit.
Same.
It's really good. It's definitely a Paul Schrader film.
Yes, it is.
And I know some people, some of the reviews I read were like, they would, you didn't need the flashbacks, but I think you kind of do. I think you kind of do, to kind of see the kind of traumatic experience that the William Tell character has went through.
And agreed.
That he's completely broken. And it's another one of Willem Dafoe's cavalcade of sleazy characters he's played in his career.
Oh, man.
he's a master at it, you know? And he doesn't go too far in this, because they don't go too far with him, but they kind of talk about what he's done. And, you know, you just kind of see his face, and he's got a mustache and stuff. And you're just like, this guy's a piece of, you know, he's a piece of garbage. You can just totally tell he's a piece of garbage. And, you know. But I really liked it. I liked all the acting in it. I didn't think the people were bad in the film. And, it's a downtrodden film, but it's a Paul Schrader film. It's a, you know, it's a Paul Schrader film. It's the complications of humanity.
Yes.
The obsessions and the way that goes sideways and stuff and what happens there. But honestly, I don't want to talk too much about it, because I don't want to give it away or anything, but it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of a optimistic film toward the end.
Yeah.
It's very weird. I felt the same way about First Reformed. It's like it goes through this pace and everything, and then it's the very end. You think it's one thing, but it's actually kind of optimistic. I don't know if that's age or what that is that makes Schrader that kind of stuff comes from. But yeah, you could tell Sadie we quit talking about bestiality films.
We're done.
Let it go. She's like, 8 out of 10, 8 out of 10. Now I can check out the Gardner film, and I'm looking forward to that, and to check out and see what's going on with Paul Schrader and gardening.
What did you think of Tiffany Haddish in the film?
She's a bit out of her element.
Yeah.
A little bit.
She's not terrible. A little out of relevant.
She's not terrible.
Casting choice. Yeah, she's okay.
Yeah, she's not terrible. Yeah, that's not the word I would use, but I would definitely use the word. And this is no fault of hers, because I like her a lot, but
yep.
An odd choice.
I agree with that. I think she's fine. I don't think she was an ideal choice for the role, but I think. She acquits herself as best as she can. She got cast. She's, you know, that's the way it goes.
I think she's overacted by, and not by any fault of her own, but she's overacted obviously by Isaac, who's a, you know, a kind of a modern dynamo. And then, I did like Ty Sheridan quite a bit. I thought he was really good in the film.
He was,
you know, this kind of lost kid. I guess the best way to explain it is, you know, one of these things ain't like the other, or whatever that saying, you know, she does kind of stick out a little bit as an interesting choice. Let's put it that way. And that's what I'll say. Don't know if it's entirely successful, but it is watchable. I'll say that. But yeah, now I can check out Master Gardener, which I've been wanting to check out anyway, because, you know, it's Joe Edgerton and Sigourney Weaver. And I just kind of wanted to see how that goes. And that on to the next Schrader. That's all I got, man. We'll take a short break, and we'll come back and talk about Prey of the Jaguar. We'll be back right after this. Actually, you know what? We didn't do any this or that yet.
Yeah, man. It's time for this or that.
Yeah. I'm moving on in the podcast. We've had podcast difficulties this morning. All kinds of chaos. Here we go. Let's play some music. This is a shit show. If I can find a way to screw this podcast up anymore, I'll do that. Yeah, how about that? Just totally forgot about this or that this week.
Listen, that's the way they go sometimes. I've got technical audio difficulties. No one said everyone was going to be easy, baby.
Nope.
Here we are. Let's get into it. We are short on time and long on heart.
All right. What do you got for this or that this week? Go ahead. I don't have anything, for the record. I have nothing Prey of the Jaguar related.
That's okay, nor do I. Steve McQueen or Burt Reynolds?
No. This is an interesting one because Burt Reynolds has made more films and therefore has more product for me to enjoy. But I don't know, man. Steve McQueen's an anomaly in motion picture history, in my opinion. And also part of the era of the tough guy that didn't have to say much. And which is, you know, a favorite of mine from, you know, Clint Eastwood to Charles Bronson to Steve McQueen to James Coburn to these guys, Lee Marvin. It's a tough one, but I'm going to go McQueen by a mustache hair.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Catherine Deneuve or Sophia Loren?
You didn't say who you were, Burt Reynolds or you McQueen.
Oh, kind of. Yeah, good point, man. I'm going to go Burt. I love both. They're very different in their approach.
Yeah, yeah.
McQueen's very minimal, kind of cool. It's all beneath the surface with him. It's in a glance. You know, the wheels are turning, you know, behind the scenes, whereas Burt's very sort of boisterous, happy, laughing, charming. McQueen's charming, but he's kind of cool and steely, whereas Burt can do that, but he prefers to have a good time.
Yeah, seems that way, yes.
Yeah, so I'm going to go with Burt. I love both, but I'm going to go with Burt.
Nice, nice.
So Sophia Loren or Catherine Deneuve?
Well, we've talked about this before, kind of, in a way, not with Deneuve, though. I think I lean more Loren right now. I think that's where I lean right now. I'm gonna go with Sophia Loren. There's just something much more, I don't know, magnetic about her for me right now. Best word I can use, magnetic. There's a pull. P-U-L-L, not P-O-O-L.
Yeah. No, I'm gonna agree with you. I love both. I don't think that either one gets enough credit for their range as actresses. Both can do comedy. Both can do serious. Both can really command the camera, not just with their beauty, but their sort of certain intensity as performers. So I think they're both incredible. They're both gifts. They're both still with us.
Yeah. 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 Hanging in there.
Which is amazing. But I'm going to go Sophia by a strand of angel hair pasta.
There we go. I thought you were going to say a mustache hair again. So,
no, no, sir.
Yeah.
One final one for you here. Donnie Yen or Sammo Hung?
Ah. Well, I mean, Yen is a, you know, he's a dynamo of a different sort, very energetic. But he doesn't have near the history that Sammo has.
No.
And, I got to go Sammo. I love Donnie Yen. We've talked about him over the years and stuff. But I got to go. Yeah, I got to go Sammo. Sammo's, you know, outside of Jackie Chan, arguably, I mean, one of the most influential filmmakers of all time in that genre. He's important. Very important. He's going to be missed outside. We said that back when we were talking about some of the films, the Warriors 2.
Warriors 2.
Yep. Yeah. He's going to be missed one day. These guys are going to be missed.
I agree. There are very few people that I think are, I don't want to say head and shoulders and make it sound like I'm diminishing Yen's contributions to film. Mm-hmm. But Sammo is such a titan in terms of behind the camera and in front of the camera. If it was just in front of the camera, it'd be very close. Mm. But when you look at Sammo's contributions to filmmaking and the industry and Hong Kong film, I think it's, yeah, you got to go Sammo.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
All right. That's it for this week.
That's it.
Keeping it and sweet.
That's it. That's
like Reds.
Yeah. While we clunkily got through it and clunkily started it. Yes.
Yes.
All right. Now we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Prey of the Jaguar from 96. We'll be back right after this.
Tocó ponerle sabor, tocó meterle vibración, figuró ponerse mosca.
All right, getting a little funky this morning. There we go. Well, that's a band called Jaguar. That song's called Guadalupe, and it's funky. All right. All right. Let's get into it here. So, Prey of the Jaguar. Here we go. Let me get into the details. Plot synopsis, 96. This was released direct to video. A cop trains in martial arts to become a superhero to go after the killers of his wife and son.
What a direct synopsis with no flourish. Hmm.
That might be apropos. This is directed by David Decatur, who has directed such things, and I mean things, as Puppet Master 3, A Husband for Christmas. He's done a shit ton.
New Wave Hustlers.
Yeah, he's done a shit ton of those TV movies. Christmas for Mary, all kinds of stuff.
Ninja.
Christmas Matchmakers, yeah. My Mother's Stalker. Wow. So I can't say anything bad about him because he's done these films, as Oric, and good for him. But an interesting series he does is called 1313. And there's a whole bunch of these. And I don't even know what they are. But, I don't know enough about him to know, oddly. But, yeah, there's a whole bunch of those films. So, he's a Canadian and a USA citizen. And he started working with Roger Corman and stuff, and he works a lot. I'm trying to think when I first came across him. And it probably would have been some kind of softcore thing that he did back in the day. And I'm looking through back through his filmography. And maybe he looks like he may have made some pornography, may have made some homosexual. Oh, well, of course. Sorority Babes in the Slime Ball-O-Rama.
That would have been probably our introduction to him.
Yeah, that would have been it. So I thought that was somebody else that directed that, but that's easily, I can tell you, my favorite film of his. And that's, not a great film, but he's made so much stuff, and I haven't seen hardly any of it. But I think I don't want to speak out of turn. I was going to say, I think he maybe kind of aims toward some homosexual horror sometimes, but I could be wrong.
I'm pretty sure he does. I don't want to speak out of turn. I feel like he is a gay filmmaker, whatever that means. Some of his stuff has more of a gay slant. Some of it has no slant. He's a pretty prolific filmmaker, as we'd said. He's done a lot of action films, horror films, porn film, like gay porn films, softcore films.
Yeah.
He works.
He works. Yeah.
From everything I've heard, he's a lovely guy. But this one came across. Oh, he did. What was he? Did he direct it? No. So he's been on our show. He's right. He does writing. He's been in the industry for so long. Right. So, he's a guy that I've always heard good things about behind the scenes, and I've always kind of found his work gleeful and charming despite some budgetary restrictions at times.
Yeah, it's weird. He's one of them guys that seems like he'd be kind of synonymous with our show in a way, because he, you know, was a big part of the era of straight to video and stuff like that. But there's really only a handful of his films that I've seen.
Yeah, but he's a guy like some of his action films are pretty fun. Some of his horror films are pretty fun. But this one, the reason it came across or came to my attention was, to be very forthright, we hadn't done anything kind of, you know, just off the beaten path, kind of like a junk food kind of show in a while. Sometimes I worry about picking stuff that's too highfalutin all the time. So I thought, well, we got this ridiculous costume. We get David Ducato making a superhero film in 96. We get Stacy Keach, Linda Blair. We get Paul Bartel as sort of a Q-type character. Kano from Mortal Kombat as the Heavy. Let me dive in.
Yeah.
So we did. And here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, you got this one stars Maxwell Caulfield.
Yeah.
Who they really tried to give a push in the 80s. And this is 96. So he's still.
More than I do. I feel like you like him because of your Grease.
Yeah. Probably that. I think he's got a great look. I think he's got a great face.
He does have a great face.
Very movie star matinee. Although the fake mustache in this is really a struggle to get there. I'm pretty sure that's a fake mustache.
I just kept it, but I guess it would have been, you know, in line with the Jaguar. But
yeah, he should have kept it. Yeah, would have given him away.
True.
But he does have a great face, and he's had a few cult performances over the years. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I like him because of my love of Grease too. But never really anything outside of that. I think there's a Charlie Sheen film him and Charlie Sheen did that was pretty good, and there's a couple other things he's done in between that are okay, but he's never really had the career I think that they planned for him. But that's when where it gets interesting. It gets interesting in the kind of cast he pulls together in the background, which is, you know, Stacy Keach, you know, cashing a paycheck in the 90s here. With a ponytail. The ponytail era.
You know what he looks like? He looks like the love child of Razor Ramon and Steven Seagal in this.
Yeah.
In turtlenecks perpetually.
He looks like the stepdad you don't want.
He definitely looks like the stepdad you don't want. He is very oily.
Yeah, he's good in the film, though. I mean, again, because, you know, he's Stacy Keach, and, you know, he's really good in the movie.
He's going to give you an honest day's work, even if it's one day.
Yeah. And then, of course, Linda Blair, who's, you know, she's Linda Blair. I mean, she's not great in the film. She's not bad in the film. She's just kind of in between. She's just kind of there with the suspenders.
That has a little star power. She's a cop in the film.
Yeah. Trevor Goddard, who, you know, that's the one I'm assuming you called him. He's the Heavy in Mortal Kombat, right?
He's Kano, yeah.
I know him more for that film we reviewed a long time ago, Flexing with Monty. He's the star of that film.
Oh, wow. I'd forgotten about that film.
Yeah. He's the star of that. And that's what I remember him for all the time. He died young. But he tried to make it. He really did. He worked hard in his early career and really tried to make it as an actor.
Yeah, but unfortunately, 40, 20 passed.
Fortunately, he did not make it as an actor. But he has a look. Got a gold tooth in this. it's funny in the movie. His name is Bandera, and yet throughout the film, people are calling him Banderas. I don't know what's going on at that point. Paul Bartel comes in as the toy maker here.
And he's very fun in a small role.
Yeah,
sure.
He's very fun in just a little small role. You know, he did stuff like this all the time, so he can make films himself. Apologies, my voice is going in and out and has been for a couple of weeks. Been a little under the weather. Paul Regina? Regina? I want to say Regina because, you know, it's funnier. Now, I remember him from a TV show when I was a kid called Brothers on Showtime. But he was and he played a homosexual character. And I remember that was a big deal back in the day. And that would have been the 80s. And that was a big deal. And kind of groundbreaking at the time. And the reason why that's interesting Midnight Cinema-wise is because it starred, one of the brothers was the guy that played the Santa Claus in Christmas Evil, a Canadian actor. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's Fiona Apple's dad, I believe.
Yeah. Is it Lawrence Frank?
No, I don't think so. No.
I'm mixing up my Canadian actors.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun to kind of go back and look at that stuff. It's so 80s, that show, Brothers.
Sadly, he died young as well.
Yeah. So, wow. He did die young. Wow. I didn't know that. But he had he was a good looking guy, had a look and stuff. And it's interesting, him in this film. I'll say that. I think that's just about it. I guess I should mention character actor. What's his name?
Really good ones in here.
John Fujioka.
He's fun and he's not given a lot of range to play with, but he's kind of fun as Master Yi. Stephen Vincent Lee is really fun as like the kind of the heavies kind of right hand man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's really fun in the film, but more importantly, with all due respect to Mr. Lee, is a guy that missed opportunity. David, you should have featured more Vincent Klin in your film.
Yeah, it's more Klin. Got to have more Klin.
Got to have more Klin. 110% more Klin.
Plays a character named Sonny DePazos.
Yeah.
It's like he dropped it in the mob Rolodex there and just come up with DePazos.
The mob goon name generator.
Also fun for fans of reality TV, this was the first time that anybody had ever seen Jerry Manthe, who would go on to be on Survivor and be a very popular part of Survivor. And then would turn that into a small film career and B movies and stuff. And, that seems kind of, but you gotta remember how popular Survivor was. I mean, it's still going. Jesus Christ. There's like 50 something seasons of Survivor.
Oh, gosh.
But, she was a huge part of that early success of Survivor. So anyway, all right, let's get into it proper here. You pick this, so I'll lead on it and I'll try to be entertaining here because I got to be honest with you. This film was a bit on the dull side. I got to be forthright and say that this felt like a film made by people who had no idea what it's like to be a dad, no idea what it's like to be a special agent. No idea what it's like to be a...
Therein lies the fun.
No idea what it's like to be a martial artist.
I think Caulfield does a pretty good job in spite of his limited expertise.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe in the dad role. I'll give him some credit in the dad role. Yeah. I'll give him some credit there, but I can't give him credit with the martial arts. He looks dreadful. Okay. Even the stuntman didn't look that great doing it, so it was pretty rough. But you do have to wonder sometimes how actors end up in things like these. And obviously, you know, it's a job.
Yes, it is.
And people end up working where they can work. But you do have to wonder how they end up in stuff like this. And I'm not saying it's the worst thing Stacey Keach has ever done or the worst thing that Linda Blair has ever done.
Definitely not.
But for me, the problem with this film, this should be a straight up revenge flick. And it feels more like, I tell you what this movie feels like to me. It feels like a TV pilot. It feels like a show, like they wanted to create a show like The Jaguar as like a show in the weekly adventures of Max Caulfield as this kind of underground superhero. And I never really, the revenge never felt real pure to me in this film. It never really felt real pure. I like the Goddard performance. It's way over the top. Yeah. It's way over the top, and that's what it had to be. And that stuff's fun. And there's some meanness to that that I liked. But the problem I had with this film was it lacks a lot of energy. For me, there's a lot of scenes of people talking about stuff, and I don't have a problem with people talking in films. I don't, but these conversations are not very interesting. They're just not. and
the filler.
they're pretty rough, and the action isn't bonkers enough, and the rest of the bad guys aren't bonkers enough. Even Vincent Klin, who I hope was going to come in and give it some energy, he's kind of there and gone, and that's kind of a shame. I do like the mustache. I do wish he would have kept the mustache. Looks more like a broom than a mustache, but I quite liked it.
It is a good broom for sure. Yeah.
And it, you know, obviously it's going for a bit of a Remo Williams type feel here too. Like a bit of a destroyer, superhero, Remo Williams type feel. Maybe again with the hope that I just have to believe that there was hope that they could turn this into some type of franchise, maybe. Even if it was a direct-to-video franchise, that it would have been there. You know, it's rated R for violence, but, there's a few gunshots and some, you know, obviously some necks being cracked. But I don't know, man. I don't know how much rated R, rated R-ness is in this film. Again, maybe I'm desensitized quite a bit. I mean, there is cussing. And, there's some cocaine at some point and alcohol and things like that. So I guess technically you could make this a rated R film, but I don't know. This is one of those weird kind of cults situations where this is really an opportunity just to turn it on and watch, for whatever reason, Max Caulfield work with Stacey Keach, and then watch Max Caulfield work with Trevor Goddard, and then watch him work with Linda Blair. And then watching work with Paul Bartel and Paul Regina, and just scene after scene after scene. Obviously, most of these people aren't on set on the same days, but but it's kind of fun to see him work off of those actors, and those are the moments I like the most. The budget here, I don't know what it is, but obviously it's very low budget, and I can't rate. I never rate a film against the budget because again, they're making a movie. So they're doing a lot more than I could do anyway, and they're taking a risk and they're going for it. But man, the Jaguar costume it's rough. It is rough, man. It is rough. They should have called him Fido. Rough, rough. That's man. It's maybe. Yeah, I'm going to say maybe. It's got to be. It's either top five or top three worst superhero costumes I've ever seen. Do you think so?
What? Have you seen? Well, Bible Man would like to have a conversation with you.
Maybe.
Lee Ames would like to have a conversation with you.
I don't know. I think Bible Man looks more like a superhero than this guy does. But, there's some fun stuff in here. I will say that. I did like the Trevor Goddard character, the Bandera character. He's definitely repping hard for 90s fashion. Big suits, big ties. The big ties. He looks like he could be hosting one of those NFL pregame shows. And then, because those guys always have the big knot. And then there's one point where he's got maybe, arguably, the longest, and this is saying something, maybe the longest V-neck sweater we've ever had on this show.
We've had some V-neck sweaters on this show.
Yeah. But this might be the longest one.
Yeah.
it goes way down there. It's almost a cardigan. It goes so low. I had a real hard time with this one, man. For whatever reason, I just, I'm a pretty open-minded guy. I am. But I just find Caulfield so dull as Derek Lee.
He always is. And I should have known. I think in my heart of hearts, I've never liked Caulfield, and I've always felt like you liked him way more than I did. But I wanted something junky. And I'll make no apologies here because I like this film a lot more than you did.
Yeah, I really did.
But I will admit that the critiques that you have are valid. Obviously, they're valid. They're your opinion. But I agree with them in that Caulfield is – never been a very charismatic actor.
Yeah. Well, I think he looks good, and I think that when he's at his best is when he's playing smarmy or shitty characters.
Right. Absolutely. But in this, like, he's asked to play the kind of the wholesome dad. And the thing is, one of the reasons I picked this was it's David DeCoteau doing superhero film before superhero films were a thing on a budget. Now I wonder, because you are so burned out on superhero films, if the fact that this is a superhero film is playing on you.
No, I don't think so. I don't know what it is about the film itself, but I don't know that I ever
fun.
I never felt any connection with him and his son or him and anything. Like when his son gets killed, and it's not a spoiler to say that when his family gets killed, I never really, you know, I wanted revenge, sure, but I never really felt it, and I think it's because of the clunky fucking, you know, looks into the past, and I don't know. It's just for whatever reason, it just doesn't work for me. And
that's fair.
Again, I am very open minded when it comes to movies and stuff. But this one,
shit on this show,
this one, I always, when it comes to movies like these, I think to myself, what, you know, why does this movie get made, and what is the, you know, the same year that this movie comes out, The Phantom comes out, the Billy Zane film.
Which is a lovely, really underappreciated.
Yeah, which is a much better version of what this is, but it's also much more family friendly. But it's a much better version of this. And to me, well, obviously this is trying to go for a little bit of revenge, but that's the thing. The thing is, this doesn't lean into, for me, the revenge elements. The bad guy is too heavy for the lead here. The bad guy is killing kids and everything else, but the lead feels like a wet piece of bread. So, you know, part of that is Max Caulfield himself, but also part of that is they never really make him, in my opinion, a real hero. He does a few roundhouse kicks, and he puts on some goggles and stuff, but you never really see him do anything else. He rides a motorcycle. There's not really much else going on. He doesn't really do a lot, and he doesn't do a lot of superheroic stuff. I don't think it has anything to do with, you know, my superhero fatigue, because going back and looking at these old superhero films is actually a lot more fun than watching modern horror films, or modern superhero films, for the record. But I think it just has to do with, I just think this stuff is just misplaced. And then I think that, you know, if there is so bad it's good, and there is so bad it's bad, outside of some key scenes in here with some fun actors, the movie is very average. I'm not saying it's terrible, but it's just very average. And I don't know, like, I often think to myself with these kinds of movies, would I watch it again? Right. And I got to be honest with you, I don't think I'd ever watch Prey of the Jaguar again. I don't think I would. And I don't think I would, if people came over, I wouldn't say, let's watch Prey of the Jaguar. Like, you know, like, you want to see a fun, bad film? Let's watch Prey of the Jaguar. I don't think I could push this on anybody.
Maybe not. Do you got any more notes?
No, I did like some of the camera work, and it does tell a story. I'll give it credit for that. You know, again, it's a movie. I found it dull, but I also, you know, it tells a story, and I got through it. I didn't turn it off. So it's not the worst film I've ever seen. No way. But, I don't know. It just kind of, it lays there. Like, I just can't think of any scene that, you know, it's like Pearl Violators. You got the great scene in the back of the truck, or, you know, Blood Hands. You got the great scene at the end where he's in the, you know, in the dilapidated building fighting. And, you know, there's these moments in these films we love that we watch, and we're like, well, we need to show this to, you know who would like this? Blah, blah, blah. You know who would like this? Blah, blah, blah. This, I can't think of anybody that I would say, hey, you guys should check this out. I can't for the life of me. Maybe superhero completist, but I don't think the Jaguar is a very interesting superhero. I think, you know what this could have done? If they would have made fun of superheroes, I think maybe this would have worked more for me. Maybe the earnestness of this one just got to me, because it is very earnest.
So Ducato, that's an interesting point, because I think Ducato could have put a winking eye on the genre.
Yeah, Sorority Babes and the Slime Ball Bolorama or whatever is very much a winky winky film.
For sure. I like this a lot more than you did. I've been forthright in saying that. I think that this does try to have its cake and eat it too from the perspective of, it wants to be almost like not G, but like a PG family film in a way, right? It wants to have this angle, the kills of the wife and son are done off screen. So it wants to appeal to family, but also wants to appeal to the dude renting action movies on a Friday night.
Yeah.
It wants to kind of have both. Now, for me, this works perfectly fine. We've seen much better. The family Donahue, you know, so many people that we love from an action film perspective have done it better. Mm-hmm. Undeniable. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think it's an interesting curio piece from a filmmaker who never worked in superhero films.
Yeah.
Cast is enough for me to, you know, and they're all fine. They're all professionals, right?
Like, yeah,
you said, Keech is really good. Bartel is really good in a small role. He's fun. Blair's, you know, she's fine.
Yeah, they give that one actor, I guess it's Tom Bedell, who plays Roger, I think, the cop. They give him a lot of screen time.
Yeah, which, you know, maybe they shouldn't have, but
he's playing the, you know, the smoking, drinking cop, and he's playing it full tilt.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But Stephen Vincent Lee, like I said, as Tanaka, the right-hand man for Goddard, he's really fun, I think, as a heavy.
Yeah, he's good, yeah. Yeah. I like him.
I think he's really fun. I think, fun fact, the kid that plays Caulfield's son in this, he was one of the three finalists for Anakin Skywalker, man.
Well, judging how that turned out, and that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, he was one of the three finalists. So let me just get into a few quick things, observations, because we got to jump off this review. Two words for you when it comes to the look of this film and the cinematography: Dutch angles.
Oh yeah, and moving Dutch angles at that. They move around.
It's like he got paid by the Dutch angle. Every Dutch angle he shot, you got X amount more, but I think that's more to kind of convey this kind of comic book feel for sure. But very Dutch angle heavy. I felt like, you know, Goddard is a physical presence. Lee is good. Fujioka's fine. There's some people that are competent from an action movie martial arts standpoint. Caulfield was fine for me with the stuff he had to do. I've seen much worse. You know what's funny too? This has like Foxy Brown credits, like the opening of the film.
Yeah, it's weird. Credits. Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird credit sequence. Actually, it's one of my favorite things about the film, to be honest with you. But
interesting. I love the mustachio Caulfield, but yeah, there's that thing of, you know, they got to shave his mustache, which ironically makes him more unrecognizable.
Yeah, the film is shot by Howard Wexler, who's worked a lot with Decatur, but he also worked with Andy Sidaris a lot.
Yeah,
which makes sense because it kind of looks like an Andy Sidaris film too, right?
Yeah, for sure. We get the murder of the family off screen, which I think takes away some of the punch of it for sure. But I don't know, I like the funness of. We see Caulfield dipping ninja stars in poison, and there's a montage where he's like dipping his ninja stars. He's doing some curls for his biceps. He's getting his crossbow and nunchucks out. He is a specimen. You know, say what you will about his performance. Physically, from his look, like body, you know, working out, his looks, he fits the bill.
Yes. Yes, he does. He doesn't have the word I'm looking at. Yeah.
He doesn't have the
There's something off about him, and that's probably been the problem his whole career.
Well, because people want him to be the face, and when he's the face, he's not as good as when he can be the heel, right? Yeah. He is fun and relishes playing the heel, and he does it well.
Yeah, because he's a handsome guy. That's probably the problem, is that he's a movie star handsome guy.
His gift is his curse, right?
Yeah.
But people that get to have him as sort of smarmy know that he's really good in that. How about the line, "I'm Jaguar"? Tell him he better pray, because he is prey. That's amazing.
I mean, it's good. I don't know if I can get on the amazing train with that. It's good.
Well, I am at the front. I am at the front of the amazing train on that. I'm on the front of the amazing train for the plethora of mini ponytails in this film.
There is a lot of mini ponytails. Yes.
Lots of mini ponytails. Headlining them all is Stacy Keach with turtlenecks and mini ponytail.
And glasses.
And glasses.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, listen, I would never say this is a classic. I would never say this is Pantheon. I wouldn't even say the word Pantheon. You know, people that...
No. I you wouldn't say that. No.
No. God, no. I'll say this. For me, I had fun with it. I hadn't watched something like this in a while. We get faces that we know and love.
I mean, it's garbage cinema, but what you get out of it is what you want out of it, I think, you know? Yeah. And you know, sometimes this stuff works, right? And sometimes it don't. I think of Adam Rifkin's Invisible Maniac. Well, there's another one that, you know, it didn't touch you, but it's always oddly touched me. Well, so you just never know.
You never, right?
Yeah. You roll the dice, right?
I'd recommend this. I think people that have a forgiving nature, you could do a lot worse. This is on YouTube. Yeah. Hey, listen, the other thing this thing does well is it knows it doesn't need to be 110 minutes.
Oh,
it's like 89
yeah.
minutes long.
Yeah.
Ducateau is a very competent filmmaker from the perspective of he works in genre. He loves genre. He knows what his audience is. So I think the crime this commits is it's a little betwixt and between because it wants to, like I said, appeal to the dude renting action movies on a Friday night. And it wants to also appeal to him being able to watch it with his family.
Yeah.
So you kind of cancel out both ends a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's made to generate, hopefully, copies sold. Definitely copies rented, right, at the time. And that's what you're hoping for. And again, it's early superhero era. So they're looking to, you know, create any kind of, you know, if you remember the early superhero cycle, you had stuff like the Shadow and the Phantom and stuff like that. And they're trying to capitalize on that stuff and hope that stuff hits.
Yep.
This is before the Marvel Universe. So, you know, you're kind of hoping it hits. And
that's how it goes. You lose some.
Yeah, I mean, it's seven years after Batman, Tim Burton's Batman. So, I don't know. It just, for me, it doesn't work. There's not enough style. There's not enough. I like the scenes with the heavy actors. Not just the heavies, but the ones where
he breaks out from like prison. I think that's pretty fun.
That's pretty good. Yeah. So the opening of the film is pretty good.
It's strong.
Yeah. The opening I liked, and I was sitting there thinking, okay, this might be a lot of fun. This has what we want. It's very simple, but this is exactly what we want. Right. And then it gets to Caulfield and his family. And again, I found it boring, but at the same time, I'm like, okay, I'll buy in, you know. He knows nothing about basketball, probably, but that's okay. Let's just roll with it.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll roll with it. The kid's showing him the comic book pictures he's drawn of a superhero he made up. I like it. I like the ideas. Yeah. I like it. But
yeah,
then
we should see.
But I'm sorry. It falls apart literally for me. It's solid for me up until Goddard shows up on the roof. And once he shows up on the roof and what transpires there, good stunt onto the dumpster.
Yep.
What transpires there from that point on, it lost me. And I don't know why.
Yeah.
Yeah. But from that point, that's fair. So I guess I'd say the first 20 or 30 minutes are pretty decent for what it is.
Yeah. Cause we should say like the whole kind of as earnest and well-meaning as it is, it's pretty ridiculous. So Caulfield's character, like his, alter ego, the Jaguar, is based on drawings that his son made of a made up superhero. So it's this very earnest thing.
Which is
clunky, but well intentioned, I guess. But anyway, I think we gotta put this Jaguar in the cage, baby.
Yeah. I want to mention that there was a first assistant director on the film named Clinton Canada, and that's a superhero name if there ever was one.
It sure is.
That's your national superhero, Clinton Canada, baby.
Yeah.
Good old Clinton Canada. Make or break for me. I'd say sometimes with these you have breaks. And this one's, it's not a scene, but it's multiple scenes. But I got to say, I did not like Maxwell Caulfield as a superhero. And for me, that's where this film is broke. And again, I'm totally fine with Max Caulfield. I really am. Not as a great actor, but as somebody who, you know, has a look and he is what he is. But I could not buy him in this role no matter how hard I tried. And I tried. Let me tell you, I tried. By the time it gets to the one fight scene with him and the Vincent Klin and those guys, Even the stuntman I was struggling with. So pretty rough. And so I'm going to give it a break on that end. My MVT for the film, though, is pretty easy for me. And it's Keech, because he's in here. And even though this is a trashy film in the sense that it's very much a B movie, you know, Keech is he's a pro. He comes in, you just buy him as this chief with this ponytail and yeah, he looking like he just got off a bender, but you know, he's really good in the movie, right? I mean, he's Stacy Keach, and bravo to him. Also Clinton Canada, first assistant director on Totally Nude Aerobics.
Amazing.
Got to find that film. We need to watch that. Yes. Wonder if it's male and female. My hunch is probably not. Ooh, I don't know. There's some males in the cast. Hey. Like, yeah, Downward Dog. And, yeah, ooh, Teabag to the face. Anyway, sorry, I'm being childish. But I'm going to go with Keech as the MVT because I do think he is actually pretty good in the film for what it is. And I did like those first 15, 20 minutes, whatever it is, man. It's pretty standard action fare, but it works. What am I going to give this film? I'm going to go right down the middle, man. I'm going to split it. It's going to be 5 out of 10 for me. Average.
Ooh, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yep. I didn't, I didn't hate it because I watched it and I got through it. I didn't fast forward. Nothing like that. We've done some films on this show where I've just wanted to hit that fast forward button so damn bad. I've never done it. Not for ones we reviewed. And this one, I never had the inclination to do so. So there you go. I mean, that has to say something. It's at least a movie.
Yeah. Make or break scene for me, the toy maker scene with Bartell. I like that. It's fun. Like I said, Bartell is his cue, essentially. It's a fun scene. I always like seeing Bartell pop up and, you know, it's just, it gives it a bit of a sandboxy fun moment. MVT is the supporting cast. You'd mentioned Keech. Your Keeches, your Bartels, your Goddards, your Lees. Seeing all these people in the film, they're good. They're fun. They're what they need to be, right? They're fine. For me, a score on this one's a little higher than yours. It's a 6.25 out of 10. I enjoyed it well enough. Maybe I'd watch it again. I'm not going to rush to watch it again. It's not a stone cold classic, but listen, I've watched way worse. I've watched things that really dragged ass. For me, it didn't really drag ass. It's under 90 minutes. Decato knows what he's doing. I've always liked him, like I said, as a filmmaker. It's a curio piece in his filmography. And if you're familiar with his work, to see him do a superhero film, you know, it's a curio piece, if nothing else, right? So I think it's an enjoyable film. You could do a lot worse. We'll do a lot worse again.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, we'll do a lot worse. I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt about that. Somebody will pick something or we'll pick something and we'll do worse. There's no doubt. All right. That is the big show. That's also available on Tubi for those who want
to
watch
it. Tubi in the States, which I got the rug pulled out from under me.
Oh, man. Tubi in the States.
Tubi in the States, Plex in the States, Fubo in the States. I have all three. I didn't get it on none of them. I threw a Hail Mary to YouTube.
There was.
He caught it. There it was. They caught it.
Weird. I thought Tubi was one of the ones that didn't, you know, it wasn't regional. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, man. I got shafted at like 4:30 this morning watching this one.
You got tubed.
I got tubed hard.
Man, what the hell? Anyway. Definitely, you know, check it out if you're interested in that kind of thing. And again, if you're a superhero completist, you definitely probably want to check it out because it might be one you've not heard of. So. Let's see. Make sure to check out our other fellow shows. Not a Bomb, Watch Get Plus, which I think is going on a hiatus. I'll announce this here for a little while. They got some stuff going on and stuff, so they might be going on hiatus for a little while to get things sorted. But definitely check out their back catalog. They mostly do newer films. But Jose and Justin, longtime friends of us, and, you know, wish them the best. Anytime a show goes on hiatus, it's because lives get very busy. This is a hobby, not a job. So, unfortunately, with hobbies, sometimes life doesn't care if you have a hobby. Life really doesn't care that you have a hobby. Am I right?
It
does not care at all, buddy. Let's see. Maverick Clickers, love this album. Raiders of the Podcast. So many. I'm trying to think. Love this. What I see here podcast.
Here, yeah.
Oh man, there's so many. I just don't. I can't keep up.
You said Watch the Plus.
Yeah. Not a bomb. Just check everybody out. Night of the Living Podcast. There you go. And just, you know, check it all out. And usually if you pull up any pod service, a lot of those shows will probably come up as recommendations anyway. Probably read some kind of algorithm.
Yep.
All right. When we come back, this is in the future, so I have no idea what we're doing. So we'll just have to report back.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned and we'll let you know. But I think that's all I got. I'm going to say adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.